And there's 50 of you, so that's about 9 each, just a little bit under 9. So what they'll be coming in is at 1:30 today, they'll be introducing themselves and saying a little bit more about their topics. And then you'll have a piece of paper, and then you'll put down your three preferences for which topic you'd like to have. Now, we won't be able, just from past experience, I know we won't be able to guarantee that everyone will get their correct topic or the topic they put number one. So all of the scientists are going and talking about very, very interesting stuff. They're all excellent teachers, so no matter which person you go with, you'll have a fantastic time. So we'll try as much as we can to sort people out, but if you don't get your first preference, then it won't be the end of the world. If you do, that's a bonus. So we have Rowan Thompson. She's a PhD student here, and she'll be talking about black hole thermodynamics. So that relates to some things like Hawking radiation. And actually looking at black holes from a thermodynamic point of view in terms of their entropy and internal properties, which can actually relate to the area of the black hole. So she'll be giving a mentoring session on that. So that's, I guess, quantum gravity, you would call that. Carlos Mocon, who'll be talking this more sort of quantum information, so what Ray was talking about yesterday. And it's quantum memory. It's actually, I think someone asked the question, what if you turn the quantum computer off, how long does it, I think it was you, Dennis. Was how, if you turn a quantum computer off, how long does the memory stay for? Someone asked that, and Ray said it was about a second. But anyway, so that is actually dealing with that topic. So then string theory, if anyone's interested in string theory, so on Grib. So I think some of you have kind of met him, seen him kind of out there. He's kind of a tall guy just in the office out there. He'll be talking about string theory. It's a very, very interesting topic. It's something called the ADS-CFT correspondence, which I'm sure you all know about. Which is the anti-de-Sitter conformal field theory correspondence, which is a very, very hot topic in string theory at the moment, how that relates to black holes. But he's not dealing with an ordinary garden variety three-dimensional black hole. I think it's a nine-dimensional black hole or something like that. So that's his topic. That's a little bit more mathematical, so if you're kind of more mathematically inclined, then that could be a good one for you. Namani, whoops, actually there's two, there's only meant to be one Namani there, so that's wrong way. Right, okay, so Namani, he's a string theorist as well, string theorist from India, and he'll be talking about bosons and fermions, so the two fundamental types of particles. So bosons are kind of the force particles like the photon, the W. Stefan briefly mentioned the W plus, minus, and Z naught. They're also bosons for the weak force. And that's kind of switching between the two, bosons and fermions. So that's kind of more quantum field theory. So that's an interesting topic. So John Hackett, who's a great researcher, talking about mathematical physics and quantum gravity. And that will tie in with the loop quantum gravity. So kind of you're interested in that. That would be very, very good. And so it's known as kind of abstract mathematical physics. It's actually quite non-mathematical, and you get to actually play around with pictures and things. So John's a great guy. And then if you're more in kind of the foundations of quantum theory, so remember I talked about the many worlds interpretation and the entire universe splitting up into two when the individual photon has to make a choice. So if you're kind of more into that, and also Schrodinger's cat, so if that kind of grabs you, then probably maybe the last one. So Ward Streeter, again, a very cool guy. And so he looks in the foundation of quantum theory, and I'll be looking at something called the pilot wave interpretation, which is another different way looking at quantum mechanics, which I haven't talked about. So they're essentially the six choices that you'll have. That will be at 1:30. And we'll do that. You write them down. And then from 2:30 to 5, you'll basically be scattered throughout various parts of the building, and we'll be doing that. So that is the mentoring section. So any more announcements? Okay, right. So just to kind of give you a bit of a landscape kind of view, what I did is... Oops. Right. So kind of last night, I thought, well, just to kind of give you an idea of where, oops, so if we just zoom out. Turn on the lights on there. Okay, is that better? Okay, great. So that's kind of my little schematic chart of the entirety of modern physics. So I don't think we'll be getting through all of it by next Wednesday. Yes? Oh, right. No, that's actually meant to be cosmology. So we'll just shift. Yep, good point. So just somehow cosmology got shifted over. We just do a little translation there on cosmology. That's kind of a schematic chart, and obviously they're very much interrelated to each other. So really the two twin pillars of modern physics, as I talked about, so there's quantum physics. We've been spending a lot of our time there. But if you look, there's pretty much an arrow from quantum physics to most other things, and I guess there probably should be one to particle physics as well. So basically, and like I said, everyone in this building that's doing research does something on quantum physics. So the quantum physics that we've been looking at has actually applications pretty much any area in modern physics. So superstring theory, loop quantum gravity, trying to unite quantum physics with general relativity, so you need to understand some quantum physics. So we're spending a lot of our time there. And so Michael, next Tuesday, will be talking more about general relativity. So that's for light poles. And roughly speaking, that's physics of the large, physics of gravity that we have. So we'll be, you may have heard, so Einstein's theory of relativity is split into two parts. So there's special relativity. So we'll be spending probably about an hour on that. Because as interesting as it is, it's actually just a special case of general relativity. So that's why it's called special relativity. It doesn't deal with acceleration. Then basically kind of the two combine in quantum gravity. And so quantum physics is one people still do research on it, but the basic core theory is developed. So it's known, same with general relativity, although people still do research sort of filling out the gaps and expanding our knowledge. So quantum gravity, that's very much a work in progress. So we're kind of building up to that. And I think in the last day we have Patini, and she's one of our researchers here at Perimeter Institute. And she'll be giving a talk on her research in quantum gravity. So that's quantum gravity, and that kind of splits off the two approaches there, loop quantum gravity and superstring theory. And you'll be hearing a bit about those. So, and then we kind of, you know, the foundations of quantum theory and quantum information are kind of offshoots there. We've kind of touched on those, and then there's cosmology and particle physics, and then of course astro-particle physics. So that's kind of the landscape that we're getting through, and hopefully we're kind of getting this part of our head down somewhere more towards quantum gravity by the end. So normally this takes about 7 years of university education to do this, but we've got 8 days, so they're a smart bunch. So okay, so we have another keynote presentation, I should say, you all know, at 10:30 today. So from 10:30, well, actually after the break, so roughly 10:40 to 12. And that will be Lee Smolin, and one of our researchers. He's been here from the start. And he's actually talking about approaches. Well, I'm not exactly sure what he'll be talking about. You never can really tell. But whatever it is, it'll be fascinating. But certainly if you ask him, he'll talk about loop quantum gravity. And that's, again, so did you all read the article?
Yeah,
there was a page missing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Sure? Must have been a quantum fluctuation. So, okay. Well. So maybe your exercise for tonight is to figure out what was written on the business page. So sorry for that. That was my fault. But hopefully, give you some idea about quantum gravity. You know, just to kind of get your mind in gear. And so Lee was one of the people that invented it, the co-discoverers of loop quantum gravity in the 1980s. So he was back there. Okay, so on to the physics. So we talked about the problem, the quantum seeing in the dark, the 25% version where we had... So you all got this right. Diamond, and depending on whether the diamond's here or not, you have a 0% chance when there's no diamond. 25% chance when there is dying. So this is how to see something without interacting any light with whatsoever. So this is a strange quantum effect. And this was, again, I think I mentioned it to you, 1993 by... by Ellis and Weidman. So if you did this in your 1993, I gave this exercise, you got the right answer, you could actually publish that as a paper. So the next version, and this was published in 1999, was the 100% version. Did anyone get the
99.99999?
Really? Oh, that's. Did anyone else actually hands up if you got it off or you got pretty close to it? Okay. Do you want some more time to think about it?
No.
Yes?
When the photon reaches a polarizer beam splitter.
Oh, okay. Do you want me to go through this now?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, let me see. Okay, so we'll go through this for a little while. So this is the paper. Yeah, so that should. So high efficiency quantum interrogation measurements by the quantum Zeno effect by Quiet, White, Mitchell, Greer, White, Weinkreder, and Anton Zeilinger. So all the answers contained in there, and actually. One thing I should mention is basically all the physics papers. So there's one website, essentially, where I got this from. And you see there's kind of a number down there, QuantPH and archive, and then the 9909083. So there's essentially what people do now, what all the scientists do, is even before they get their papers published, they write them up and they put them on one website. And so basically it's kind of, it's a preprint server because they're pre-publication papers. But this is where I got this from. So it's a weird address, but this is actually what it is. No, it's not that. it's the other way around, lanl.com. So this is... So, you know what the HTTP for the XXX, apparently the scientist when he was designing it didn't know what to call the machine, so just called it like XXX as just kind of, I don't know, some generic thing. And LANL stands for Los Alamos National Laboratory, that's actually where Relaform used to work at. That's a US government research facility in New Mexico, in Los Alamos, which is where the Manhattan Project was, the first atomic bomb during the Second World War, and the Gov just for the US government, that's their kind of the end. So you go there, you can see about 10 different fields. There's quantum physics, there's cosmology, there's quantum gravity, there's biological physics, and every day, at least the quantum physics one, basically pretty much every scientist in this building checks that religiously. And all the scientists around the world do. It's like the place to check where all the new results are coming out. Before even they're published, they basically just get sort of stored there electronically. So that's a pretty big place. Okay, so so this was a very, very hard question. So, So what I might do, so I don't want to spend too much time on it, so I might just kind of go through it, kind of qualitatively give you an idea of what's happening. Hands up who thought about it last night. Hands up.
The entire 2 hours.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, okay. So what I said is I just wanted to make sure that you had something that was hard, okay. I didn't want you to go be writing postcards saying this. Okay, so I guess this is the idea. So we have this idea of polarization. So I guess starting from the start, really. So hands up if you're familiar with this idea of polarization, or okay, so. Okay, so about half are, half not. So I'll just go through this a little bit. So this idea, so Maxwell came up in the late 19th century, said that you can think of light. So there was this whole idea of what's light made up of. He said it's a particle, other people said it's a wave because it diffracts and you get interference effects, and what is light? And so Maxwell, in around about mid-19th century, came up with a new idea. And he said, look, light is made up of electric and magnetic fields, electric and magnetic vibrations. So if we have, say, a laser beam traveling in this direction, might, for example, consist of. So basically all it is just an excitation, these electric field vectors, this electric field here, and this sort of represents the electric field at a particular time as it goes in space, kind of oscillating and undulating. And not just an electric field, but there's a magnetic field there, which really kind of, I should be drawing in and out of the page. It's a bit hard to draw, but it kind of goes, well, something like that. There. Anyway, you kind of get the idea, in and out of the page. So that was his, that was Maxwell's view of light. And so sometimes the electric fields, the vectors, they don't oscillate just up and down the page, but for most light, say the light coming out of here, it's actually everywhere. So in all directions. So it's kind of hard to get, but that's sort of the light heading this way in the direction. And the electric field vectors every which way at right angles to it. So that's unpolarized light. Polarized light, so this is an example of polarized light, where the electric field vector is just constrained to be in one particular plane. So it's actually in the vertical plane here. And so it turns out, does anyone have a digital watch? Oh, is there any digital watch? Okay. Does anyone have a cell phone on them? Okay, so we might actually do a little experiment now. So coincidentally, I'll just check if these work, actually. So, yep, okay, great. So what we have is we have about 10 pairs of polarized sunglasses. So, okay, so I will need your cooperation for this. So it turns out that, so you look at the light coming from here, it's unpolarized. These are actually polarized sunglasses. And so what these are, these lenses are kind of like filters. And so they only let through light at a certain polarization. And for example, they might just let through light that's horizontally polarized. So, horizontally polarized. Oh, you've got some, great. So what happens actually is with this. What are we doing?
Oh,
no. What do you want me to?
Okay.
Sorry. Sorry.
I thought you were asking about polarization glass.
No, just in a, no. Sorry. In a minute. Okay. So so Barbara has some, a lot of people have some. And So what they do is they're like filters, so that if you have light that's polarized like this, and you have the sunglasses a particular way, then, well, I guess these are the sunglass lenses, and they let through the light because they're a vertical filter. They let through vertically polarized light. This is vertically polarized. But if you get the sunglasses and turn them around 90 degrees, then this changes the filter from being... Oh, that's bad. I need this. Okay. When in doubt, just get a bigger thing. Okay. So if you rotate it around by 90 degrees, it changes to that. So if you're kind of on this side, so this is you, you've got the sunglasses on. So you, does that make sense? Okay, I'm going to art school, by the way. So the light is vertically polarized, the filter is horizontally polarized. So do you see any light at all?
No.
Exactly. And so if you do that, you turn around, and you have a polarized source, you actually see it go dark. So with this light here, it doesn't actually change, it's unpolarized. But what I want everyone to do is find someone that either has a cell phone or a mobile phone, or a watch, and then actually put the glasses, probably the easiest thing is to put the glasses on, and then actually turn the watch or the cell phone around 9 degrees. And you should actually see the screen go dark. And that's because basically you've got this situation, because the watch or the cell phone or the mobile phone is emitting polarized light. Yes?
Shouldn't it work with the projection too?
Yeah. So it's kind of weird, but it's a bit hard to see with the projector. So this one's a little bit weird. I think it polarizes different colors, different angles, but certainly standard. Computer screens, it does what computer screens do. So what I'll do is... Okay. Done. Okay, yes. Well, okay. Okay, so maybe I won't throw them anymore. So the goal is to find out which sources of light are polarized and which are not. So, Stephen? Okay. You, Raj? Yep. Okay. That's right, Marius. That's right. Okay, Hale. Okay, and pass them back. Okay, so which sources of light? Okay, so does my BlackBerry emit polarized light, yes or no? Okay, sure?
Yeah.
Okay. Test it. Okay, if you have a calculator too, see if that is correct. Sorry about that. Do you have your nightcap? Okay. That was the thing. Okay. Right. What? But it should change? Did it change?
Yeah, I can see it.
Can we get some photos of everyone with the cool sunglasses on? Yeah, oh, calculators too, thank you. Yep. Okay, has everyone had a look? Okay, one more minute and then. Have a look up at the lights up there and see they're unpolarized. You should be able to turn them around and it doesn't affect them. Okay, that's enough time.
I can actually make a light bulb go black just by doing this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So this, the light bulb does go black.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, Matthew, Michael. Power. But what do they do? You mean the calculator screen? Or the sunglasses? So I'm not. Mark, how do the sunglasses, how does the polarization work?
It just doesn't fit through. The material is a plastic in which they embed iodine, and then when they pull it, it lines up the crystals, and those crystals are polarizing crystals, and that's how they get a Polaroid filter.
Okay.
Edwin Land, a Polaroid company, was the fellow who invented that and provided the money for his company.
Right.
Okay, so, it's plastics and stretching.
Okay, yeah. Thanks. Okay, so if I could have the sunglasses back.
With regards to this, I don't know, these people should know that now if they go in to look for Polaroid sunglasses to buy, there are cheap versions and there are good versions. So what you do is you take them and literally cross them in the store. The store is hating because I'll go in on the Polaroids and I'll be taking them like this and I'll just not buy a nose because they don't blacken out enough. They should go almost to black, and when you look through, you might see a little bit of purple. And that's a good Polaroid lens.
Yeah.
There's cheap lenses out there, and that's how you check. It should go to zero.
So that was what you're saying. What Matthew was doing. If you get two of them, can I have two? And
yeah.
Can I have that, Stephen? So you used to get two and actually put them kind of crossways, and okay, I can't really see Mark at all.
Okay, so that's what you do when you're in the store, because there are cheap ones that will not darken down all the way, and they're not going to have the same effect.
Yeah. And then we can't really show it, but the cool thing is you can get. Actually, do we have a third one? Can I have? So actually, could you just hold those like that? So John holds those like that, and if Elisa, can you look through, and then does that look like black to you? You can't see me. Okay, so if you just move that, so that should still be black. So if you could just hold that. Okay, if we put a third one in, we rotate that around, does that get less black?
It kept moving in and out.
Okay, so theoretically it does. So you can actually do the experiment. So it's you actually get. So this is pretty cool. But you get. Yeah, light coming in, it's unpolarized. Vertical sunglass lens vertically polarizes it, so V. And then it's only like this, and if you have a horizontal polarizer, no light gets through, so you see zero light here. But if you put another polarizer in the middle, so you're putting kind of another sheet of plastic which stops the light, you can actually get some of the light going through. And this is very weird. So basically, no light is getting through there. We put another thing that blocks out some of the light through in there, the middle here, and we actually end up seeing some light. So, and if you see this, this is weird. But this changes it to being vertically polarized, and then, so obviously not all of the light gets through, only half the light gets through here, so we have half the intensity here, and then this changes it to being 45 degree polarized, and half gets through again, so it's down to a quarter of the intensity, and then again it's down to an eighth of the intensity. So you're actually seeing sort of zero the intensity, an eighth of the intensity actually put in the middle. Whereas if we took this out, we'd get not one eighth, but a zero there. So that's a pretty cool demonstration. Okay, so that's polarization. That's a basic idea, and so that's for a whole beam of light. That's a lot of light. I mean, the calculators and your cell phones or mobile phones and your watches, there are many billions of photons every single second. What about a single photon? Can a single photon be polarized in exactly the same way we've been talking about? Can it be horizontally or vertically polarized? It's kind of weird, and you might think, well, no, because we've been drawing photons as little kind of balls and stuff and spheres and circles, and that doesn't look like something that's a wave. It doesn't look like something could be polarized, but probably maybe a more accurate way of thinking about photons is kind of like a localized wave, because I keep saying that photons have a wavelength. All the photons of different colors of the rainbow have different wavelengths and frequencies. So maybe a more accurate picture is something like kind of this sort of localized wave packet. If you think of that, well, it's got a wavy aspect to it, and this wave really is the electric field vector oscillating, and then in and out of the page is a magnetic field vector. And if you think of that as a picture of the individual photon, then it makes more sense to think that it can be polarized, and it can actually be polarized. And a way of graphically representing that we saw can be H for horizontal, V for vertical. So this is just a two-dimensional Cartesian diagram. And the photon can be polarized any direction we like. It can be horizontal, 22 degrees, any arrow along here. So that's the idea of polarization, which you're all familiar with now. And the idea of a photon, an individual photon, as opposed to a big macroscopic beam of light being polarized. So this is the idea we need. And so to actually do this, what the scientists did in 1999 was... Okay. So much better than the little... Okay. Was they got... So these are mirrors here. Just kind of four mirrors there. And then they just essentially inserted one photon. I guess you could shoot it in from one side. Well, no, you can't really. They just did that. So they just kind of sort of dropped a photon into the experiment. So let's not worry about the details, but they had one photon going in here, and that photon was horizontally polarized. So, and remember I said there was a something called a polarization rotator that actually rotated the polarization down. And so I won't worry about the details, but just to know that, and again, they have these at the Institute for Quantum Computing, that it's just some, we think of it as some black box, and it's actually just a piece of, just a piece of some special type of crystal that actually rotates the polarization around. So if we, basically can be any angle we like. So we have horizontally polarized photon there. We have this polarization rotated by an angle theta. Then we rotate it around to being polarized by that amount. So this is where the rotation is. Okay, so that's where the rotation is. And again, so very simply, mathematically, just two-dimensional vector space, we're just rotating around by that. Okay, so we have this kind of angle theta here. And what we do is the photons, so we just let the photon kind of cycle around and cycle around and cycle around and cycle around and keep on going. And if we do that, then what happens to the photon? So it starts out at horizontal, and each time it goes around, it gets rotated by the angle theta. So it gets rotated again and again and again, and eventually it ends up being up here at vertical. So after however many cycles, depending on, that will actually be, if we rotate it by, if we rotate it by angle theta, then after, so rotate it by pi over 2 theta, then it will be around to be vertical. That's just pi over 2 divided by theta. So that's the number of cycles we have to do to rotate it around doing vertical. And so this is what they did in the experiment. So this is one part of the experiment. So essentially, they just rotated the polarization in small steps. And except the only other thing they did was, so they put in this, again, we can think of this as a black box. And again, if you want to impress your friends, you call it a polarizing beam splitter. And so what that is something, again, we think of it as a black box. It's really, it's another type of crystal. And what it does is it kind of splits up the horizontal and vertical components of a beam of light and makes them go different directions. So for example, we have some light coming in here, makes the horizontal part go that way, and the vertical part go down here. So that's what that, yes, John?
Was it just one photon or a whole group of photons?
That was just, they just did it with a single photon. So, yeah, single photon. And here we have one of those, but we have them in reverse. So instead of splitting up, this one just recombines. So, again, this is kind of getting complicated, but, so it just recombines, and so what happens here, this is the setup they had. If this happens, then all this does is this photon is coming through, and it splits it up into the horizontal and vertical components, and if it's being rotated by this amount theta, then it has a horizontal component and a vertical component. So essentially, it splits it up into these two vector components, and then they go here, and then they recombine, and so it goes back to being what the, so whatever it was here, it goes, we just split it up and then recombine it. So we think, which is kind of silly, but it ends up being back the same exact state polarization of what it was before. And what that polarization state is just here, 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 rotating around, getting closer and closer to vertical. Yes?
So does it mean that after a photon goes through the polarizing beam splitter,
uh-huh,
it emerges as two bits of energy?
Yes. Well, yep, good question. So it's kind of, it's basically exactly what's happening with the half-silvered mirror. So if we actually put, so a natural way to, so if we actually put detector here and here, would we actually measure two bits of energy, one in the horizontal and one in the vertical component bits? And the answer is no. What we would only measure one photon here and one photon there. And the probabilities for measuring that would be if the photon that we put in was, and we can think of the photon here, we can represent it by A horizontal plus B vertical, where A and B are kind of like the square roots of the probabilities that we saw before, then A squared plus B squared equals 1. And so what we would find out, we would find if with probability A squared, it would be in the horizontal, we'd measure it between the horizontal, B squared, the vertical. So excellent question. Yeah. So that's what we have. So with this setup, this really, this doesn't do anything. It just splits them up and recombines. And so this setup, it actually gets rotated around after a number of cycles from horizontal to vertical. But let's say we take our multi-billion dollar diamond, and let's say we're not, so before you gave me a method for making sure it was safe 25% of the time, but that means 75% you destroy a multi-billion dollar diamond. So probably not really a good thing. So what we want to do is get 100%. So let's put the diamond here. Is this looking like anyone's solution?
Yes.
It is?
Or we don't really have a solution.
But we didn't know that we can switch the light.
Oh.
From one direction to the
other. Okay, right, yeah. Okay. So, yeah. And so essentially, what happens if you do, so no object basically eventually just gets rotated gradually from horizontal to vertical. And so after cycles pi divided by 2 theta, it goes to vertical. And then after it goes to that cycles, you can just kind of siphon the put a mirror here, look at the light, and then actually measure the polarization and see if it's vertical. And if it's vertical, there's no, you know, there's no diamond there. Now, what happens is if you put a diamond in here, then essentially what this does is really, this is like, so if you put a diamond in here, so the light's going through, it gets splits up into the horizontal and vertical components, but the vertical component never actually gets through because the diamond's blocking it, and so if there's a vertical photon, it actually basically interacts with the diamond, and then so the diamond explodes, and so you only actually get a, well, you only really get the horizontal component getting through. So what the idea is to do is basically to start with the horizontal photon and rotate this by just a teeny tiny amount. So make theta here very, very, very small. So rotate it by just a small amount, maybe epsilon or something like that. And then so it's a small amount, and then so almost all of the component goes through there, and just teeny tiny bit goes through there. So there's just a very, very, very low probability of actually getting the photon to be absorbed by this diamond. And so almost with 100% probability, it goes through there. And we're basically, when we recombine it, since it's very close, we're not getting the vertical component recombined with the horizontal component. We only have a teeny tiny vertical component. So, well, we're only missing a little bit. And then it comes back here. And then we try, so it's horizontal. And then, so we actually just rotate it back up again. And then a sensor goes through the same cycle and gets back to horizontal. And so if we keep on doing this a number of times, it stays being horizontal. And so at the end, once we go to actually measure to see whether what the polarization is, then it's vertical, no diamond. And horizontal equals diamond. So if you want to get kind of a graphical picture for representing it, with
well, You were so close.
Three. So no diameter, it just goes around, gets rotated around slightly, 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 and really these are tiny angles, epsilons. And here, it gets rotated around slightly by a tiny angle, epsilon, but we effectively block out the vertical component, so it goes back to being horizontal, rotated around again, the next cycle back to being horizontal, rotate around the next cycle back to being horizontal, and the limit of epsilon approaches zero, so the theoretical limit, it actually turns out that this stays being horizontal, you get 100% of the light going there, and so you never actually get any interacting with the diamond whatsoever, so you've got a teeny tiny angle, and so what happens is this unambiguously definitely goes to being vertical, and this unambiguously definitely stays to being horizontal, and so if there's a diamond there, the light's horizontal. If it's vertical, then there's no diamond. So you just measure after it's gone through n times. Technically, n has to be infinity, but let's not worry about that. And so you actually just measure the photon when it comes off, and you can get arbitrarily close in a finite amount of time to that. So, yes?
Yeah, for... Yeah, that last mirror thing on the bottom.
Yep.
Like, you add that in afterwards?
Yeah, you have to actually add that in. Right. You have to sneak that in after it's gone around a large number of times.
All right.
Okay. And if you had that idea in 1999, so you see there, you could have published that, and I think this was, and got a paper for that. So, that's the solution. Was it? Yes, it was very successful. Yes?
So they actually tested this out.
Yeah, they tested it out, and if you read this paper, so if you actually read the paper, let me see, okay. So if you read this paper, it goes down and so you can read there a number of intermediate a number of intermediate configurations were investigated before the arrival arrangement described above in 11, which is what I talked about before. With these, the feasibility of quantum interrogation, so they call it quantum interrogation, with ITER up to 85% was inferred. So they got up to 85%. So, and just the technical difficulties with the experiment. But that's the photo of the apparatus they have. And so actually, I don't know, you might not meet him, but it turns out, so Gregor Weiss is actually from Austria, he's from Vienna in Austria, but he's actually in Waterloo now, working at the University of Waterloo on basically this type of stuff. So, yes?
Are you adding the mirror fast to time?
Yeah.
Right, so
how did they test it? How
did they do it? How did they test it? How they do it? Good question. I think they have a really fast switch. I think it's something they call it a Pockel cell, but they have a really fast switch, and they flick the switch really quickly, or it automatically gets triggered, and it just puts in the mirror. Right, so light travels very fast. I don't think they put in a mirror, but they turn on the switch, and then I think that switch
becomes a mirror.
Becomes a mirror, exactly. Yeah. Because to actually put in a mirror, the photon's traveling at 3 by 10 to the meters per second. That's very difficult.
You have to move your hand to your back.
Yeah.
But,
oh, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's true. We leave these problems to the experimentalists. That's a... Okay. Okay, so, yes, Michael. Sorry, the vertical component does. Well, if a vertical photon goes, the vertical photon component can destroy the diamond if you have a vertical component. and you actually, basically it interacts with the diamond, then yes, it does. But we keep that really, 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 really small by making this angle theta small. So if we make it small, then obviously the vertical component is sine theta. So that's very, very small. And the limit, in the theoretical limit of theta approaching infinity, then...
Very,
yes. Yeah. So it's a little bit of a sneaky way, but it works out.
It goes many times. It goes many times.
Yes. Yeah. Right, yeah, you've got to not look at the chance of it. You've got to add up all the chances of hitting. So it turns out that does add up, but there's actually a difference between... Well, I can show you mathematically, but it turns out that doesn't matter because essentially the chances of it, of the component getting through has a different sort of scaling factor to the chances of it hitting. And so it actually doesn't, yeah, even if you take it many, many times, that still approaches zero. But yeah, that's definitely a point. Yes, Matthew.
You can ask if this is quantum mechanics in its fullest extent, because you're using a polarizing beam splitter, right?
So right.
It's not like you're giving the photon the kind of choice that it had, I guess, with the other experiments that we did, but it's kind of, it's making it split according to its properties, right?
Yeah.
Is it really a true quantum mechanics thing, or is it more just manipulating the photon going to keep
Good question. I would say it's a true quantum mechanical thing because you're dealing with an individual photon, and that's at the quantum level. And also you have this splitting up into two components, and you have this superposition of being horizontal and vertical, and you have to get them interfering and combining with each other. So I would say it's a true quantum. Okay, we have 10 minutes. And what I'd like to do now is just go back to finish up some things from before. So, actually, what we might do is, so, look a little bit at superposition. And so I talked about, do you remember when I talked about the many worlds interpretation?
Yes.
And I said I was going to get back to that. Okay, well, I'll get back to that now. So, starting slideshow, okay. So, okay, so we've got through this. Okay, so now we've done all the stuff, now comes the payoff. Okay, we can go and get excited now.
Yes.
Okay. So, you want to know what perhaps is the core defining feature of quantum physics, which ties into quantum gravity, which you see everywhere. Arguably, it's this thing, superposition. And so what is superposition? Well, we know exactly what it is mathematically. So Newtonian mechanics in everyday life, so you, baseballs, cars, trees, they're always in one place at one time. You always take one path at one time. You caught the bus here. That didn't go in some weird superposition of taking two roads at the same time. It just does not happen on the everyday scale. But when you get down to quantum level, this can happen. And what you have is this individual photon with a half-sliver mirror, and it seems to take both paths at the same time. And that is quantum superposition. That is kind of multiple possibilities being realized at once. And this is something you get all throughout quantum physics, and is one of kind of the main things that actually defines it, sets it apart from the classical world. And if I just talked about that, you read popular books, they just kind of in a hand-wavy way describe it, and they don't have any mathematics. If you want to know exactly how mathematically it's represented, we know. And in this case, by these 2x1 matrices we looked at. And if it was Newtonian physics, the photon would definitely have to take one path or the other. So the only two possible matrices you can have in a classical world are these two, photon taking path one or path two. But quantum physics, there are many, many, many more possibilities. And a photon can as you saw, it could be kind of half taking one path, half taking the other, or we don't even have to have these being of equal magnitude. We saw before, I think it had 1 over root 3 and then root 2 over root 3 here. So and this is kind of like a photon, kind of two-thirds taking the one path and one-third taking another. And we can have any numbers such that you know the condition that the sum of the square of the magnitude adds up to 1. So, okay. So that's the condition we have. And that's all we need to satisfy. And so when I talk about superposition, this is what I mean. Superposition is when any other case besides these two, when both of them are non-zero. So that's exactly mathematically what I mean. That's exactly what mathematical professional physicists mean when they're talking about this. This is the idea of superposition. This is how it's represented. And with the many worlds interpretation. So let's see what you think of this. So when they look at these two possibilities, some of them say, if you read, there's a book called The Fabric of Reality by David Deutsch. And it's a popular book, it's accessible, no equations in that. And he's a professional physicist, completely crazy, but professional physicist. And, well, don't quote me on that. But, strange enough, he was one of the people that first came up with the idea of quantum computers way back in around about 1984. So, that's David Deutsch, and his popular book, he's also a champion, a big believer in this many worlds interpretation. And what he says in the book is, he says, so if you look at these superposition states and look at the mathematics of quantum physics, so let's pick a slightly simpler example. Let's just make them the one we've dealt with before. So he says, look at this mathematics. The mathematics of quantum physics is telling us that we have sort of both possibilities realized. That, so this is a photon taking path one. A photon taking path two. So in the mathematics of quantum physics, we have both paths at the same time simultaneously. You can see that. So he says, look, mathematics is really just our way of describing the world. So it's just the mathematics that we have in good physical theories corresponds to something out there in the real world. Because if it didn't, why would the theories be so successful? So you know F equals MA. We can write mathematical symbols on the blackboard, but those kind of mathematical symbols, those human letters of the human alphabet, the English alphabet, they relate to real things out there in the world. So, you know, there's a force here when I'm pushing against here. There's a mass here when I hold this here. You can see an acceleration when a car is speeding away from traffic lights. And so what we need to do is to find what corresponding things in the real world translate over into what these mathematical things are. And so according to Deutsch, it's a very natural way to think of these two possibilities. Well, they must be happening somewhere. And the thing is, remember we said the photon seems to only take, we only measure the photon as being in two halves. We don't see Schrodinger's cat as being dead and alive. We only measure one photon with one probability and another photon with the other probability. But hey, the mathematics is telling us that there are two things happening at once. So where's the other thing happening? And so according to Deutsche Gain, it's a very natural way. Well, it must be happening in another universe. It's obviously not happening in our universe because we only see one of the two possibilities being realized. So the other possibility, which the mathematics tells us is there, is happening in an alternate universe. And so that is how we get the universe. So how do we get this alternate universe? We much of that actually had to split the entire universe up into two. So when this photon had to make a choice. And the reason we only see one is we just happen to be in one universe. But the other one, it does happen. The other one is equally as real because the mathematics of quantum physics is dictating that it happens. Are you convinced? Hands up if you're convinced.
I have a question.
Yes?
Is that only for quantum choices or like everyday choices?
Yeah. So Amy asked a question about that. Maybe she asked a question about brushing her teeth. And does that actually cause the universe to split into many possibilities? So if you believe, so quantum physics applies at the level of individual atoms. And if you believe that we're...
simply the culmination of our biology.
Exactly. Then our individual choices get down to quantum choices. So the answer would be yes.
So if we like believe fully in the many world interpretation, we do have to get a free will, like.
Right. So we asked about this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
well.
Or you can choose which one you go to.
Well, it depends what you mean by free will. Free will is a very fuzzy concept, and philosophers even still debate what exactly free will. Is. And so I would probably say I'm not really sure. To be honest, I'm not really sure. So. Yeah, it's a very yeah. Yes. Oh, okay. Oh, right. If you maybe see Mark or me later about that. Okay. Yep. Question.
So Mr. Deutsch said that the universe splits as a quantum decision is made. But is there any way that we can detect it?
Yeah, excellent question. So can we do an experiment? You're thinking like a scientist. Good. So
that's a theory, so you...
Yeah, exactly. So according to him, yes. So let's see if I get this right. So he has some experiment, and I think I'll get this right. So in other interpretations... Well, according to him and other interpretations, what happens, so if you do Schrodinger's cat experiment, and, in other interpretations, in this case, when someone with a conscious mind actually measures to see which path the photon goes down, that collapses the wave function, or collapses the wave pack and the possibilities. And we just get one of the two happening, so one of the possibilities gets rubbed out. But in his interpretation, then that doesn't happen because just what happens is you get two people, you get one person measuring that in one universe and another one measuring that in another universe. So both of the universes are still there and both of the possibilities are still there even though a conscious mind is measured there. So what you actually need to do is, so the strange thing is worlds can actually split from each other, but also strangely enough, they can actually recombine. And so they actually recombine when you interfere these two photons together. So you actually get worlds fusing together through entire universes. So the experiment Deutsch has in mind, he talks about a quantum brain. So... So you actually build an artificial intelligent computer that's sensitive at the quantum level for choices at the quantum level. So once you build that, you actually get one here and one there, and you get them to actually detect whether they... you actually have to get them to detect whether they observe a photon or not, and then actually somehow to get them to interfere with each other, sort of overlap with each other, which would be phenomenally difficult to do. And then if you do that just the right way, you can actually get them... I think you can get an experimental result where they kind of, because of the quantum interference, the two possibilities kind of mess up each other, and the quantum brain actually, which is artificial intelligent robot sensitive to things at the quantum level, gets that it actually saw a photon. And if that happens, then according to Deutsch, that will prove that his version of many worlds interpretation. Yes, Richard.
So how many universes being created in your sequence?
How many universes? Okay, I leave that as an exercise for you to do. There are, does anyone know how many atoms there are in the universe?
No. Lots.
Lots, okay. 10 to the power 78. We counted them last night. Okay, so assume there are 10 to the power 78. Okay, this is kind of like a Fermi calculation, a rough calculation. So how many, on average, how many quantum choices do you think each atom... So actually, no, I'll leave this as an exercise for you. So what you have to estimate is number of quantum choices. And then obviously just multiply those two together. And so what you'll have to think is probably in 1 second, how many atoms does every individual atom interact with on average? So obviously it depends on whether they're in the middle of space or they're here on Earth. But for example, every air, not air molecule, but oxygen or nitrogen molecule, whatever, in there is interacting with so many due to density. So, yes?
Isn't there like a big cosmology thing that space is expanding and creating matter as it goes? How can you come up with a number of atoms at any point?
So I think it's more, I don't think the number of atoms is growing, but space itself is expanding. I don't think we're... Well, it's creating dark energy as we go, according to the dark energy paradigm. But I think it's more, it's not creating any matter, but more actual space. So we assume for this calculation the number of atoms in the universe is constant, but that's a good point. Yes. Wait, we'll take two more questions and then we have to have breaks because we want to be fresh and ready for leave. Yes?
So at the end of the
atoms
expand as well?
Yes. That's a good question. Basically, the standard answer is no. It's kind of, we're not really. The gravitationally bound systems don't actually expand, but it's more the space in between them expands the standard answer. So it's kind of subtle. I don't fully get it myself, but that's the standard answer. Yes, my last question.
Second. When the universe is split, where is it and what's the
When the universe is split, where is it and what it's made of? It's somewhere else. And it's made of exactly the same stuff. It makes.
So like, where does the energy come from?
It just pops into existence.
So it's just like quantum
logic. Right, well, yeah, kind of, but on a grander scale.
I mean, fine,
but... Sorry?
That's one idea.
Yeah. Okay, so what happens is... So there are two versions. So one version you get splitting, that defies conservation of energy. Deutsch actually has a different version, which there were billions of universes at the very start, and they were all the same, but just as the universe evolves, and more quantum choices are made, the universes just get more and more different. So they actually get more and more different to each other. So we're never ever creating more universes, just they get more and more individualized as more and more quantum choices are made. So we're getting a bit restless, so we'll take a break, coffee break for 15 minutes, and then be back for Lee's follow-up.